who don't care about feminism. Your favorite show is Entourage.
To be honest, when I found out the patriarchy wasn't about horses, I lost interest anyway.
I wonder if I know what you mean.
I wonder if you wonder.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Maximum Film. It's episode 347, and you know, we love our dad that's in heaven. It's your boy, Ify Wadiway, who is hosting this with my friends and who are in the booth. So let me introduce you to Rams. You know, first up, Christmas Zaddy. Great beard, great hair. Esteemed critic. I swear to God, if y'all keep asking him about Dragon Ball Evolution, I will fight you. But also, an author. It is Alonzo Duralde. What's good?
Thank you for that. Although, weirdly, I was quoted for my Street Fighter The Legend of Chun-Li review this week. So, you know, you just never know what's going to come up. So, all right, some of my what's goods of late have been a little heady. I've been talking about books and whatnot, but can we talk about Captain Crunch Cinnamon Crunch? Because it's a game changer, people. We have not had a Cinnamon Crunch from the Captain since the 70s, and it was a short-lived cereal endorsed by his arch-villain, pirate Jean Lafitte, and they were a different shape than the usual Captain Crunch thing, and then it went away, and we've yearned for it for decades, and now it is back. And it is Captain Crunch, the shape you know that doesn't tear up the roof of your mouth anymore. That's an old thing. They fixed it, but with a cinnamon coating that for me is better than Cinnamon Toast Crunch, and I feel less insane saying so because the Empty Bowl podcast has my back on this one. The elder of the our perhaps favorite McElroy, if we can pick one, has my back and agrees with me that in fact this is a step above CT Crunch, which is fine. It's great. I'm no shade, but the Captain has taken it to the next level, and I am a cinnamon boy in a big way. So very excited about all of this.
Yeah, Every single detail you just gave made me feel more and more sure I was on mushrooms. Like every single excitement, the mention of a Empty Bowl podcast, the ranking of what your roof of your mouth would do, amazing. 10 out of 10. Don't change a thing.
I have a tight 10 on Captain Crunch and his entire family of products. So, you know.
All of it. We might have to tell Marissa when she returns, wherever you are, Marissa, that, a maximum cereal is maybe a future discussion we could have for a BOCO.
Oh, I would love it. I love a cereal.
I think of the badge we could have to go with it.
Oh. Yes. But yeah, I love a cinnamon cereal too. Like Cinnamon Life, I think, is heavily slept on as a cereal.
For sure.
But yeah, it also, they had I think Cinnamon Toast Crunch had like a churro flavor they were doing for a while that was really good. But yeah, so I'm there with you. I will stand on that hill privately. I mean, proudly.
Shrooms.
Did you say you had an enemy, Alonso?
Is there
lore and mythology to the Captain?
That's what I'm saying.
Again, it's all part of my tight 10, but yeah, so the Captain has a nemesis who is a pirate named Jean Lafitte, which is a play on the Jean Lafitte, who was an actual, you know, French pirate. And so, yeah, he was the guy who was always trying to steal the cereal or whatever. And for a bright shining moment, he got to be a mascot of his own of this cinnamon cereal that went away. But now he's on the back of the box. So they haven't completely divorced him from the proceedings, but he is canon in the Captain Crunch universe.
Thrilled Carlos is on the same trip as me. Feels good.
All right. Well, you know what else feels good? You know, being in the arms of the queen of the Midwest, super festival programmer, producer, Drea Clark. What is good?
First off, I do want to say that my dad is not in heaven. He's in Sonoma County. So
My dad is alive as well. But it was a reference to the movie today.
I got it. No, you nailed it. I mean, you're very good at those things. I just didn't want the karma of that. You know what I'm saying? I didn't want to be in that umbrella. I've already
mine is dead. So we have somebody coming.
Mine's also gone. So
Yeah, okay. Feel great that I brought up this thread. Super good about that.
Look, we got a 50. We got a 50-50 ratio. This is solid pod ratio. We have the folks that connected with certain elements, which, I know it's going to be juicy and fun.
Oh, my gosh.
But we have people who's like, okay, I'll feel that one day.
Yeah. Well, we'll all get there. But anyway, 1,000 degrees away from that, my what's good, similar to Lonzo, bringing it back to my own, just the reality of me and the things that make me happy. Skincare. Anything related to skincare, you know, is my jam. One thing that I love, as many of the skincare girlies do, girly being a gender neutral term in this usage, is a face mask, which are those often Korean masks, and they're like soaked with serums and you slap them on and you look horrifying. It's kind of a Mrs. Doubtfire if you squint your eyes scenario, but they are, I love them and I love how they feel, but they're terrible for the environment. Like they don't decompose well. They're just a whole hot mess. So did I invest in 2 silicone reusable masks? And so now I love them so much. And you just pack on an extra layer of whatever fancy ass serum you already have. You know, I have 1,000 of them. And then you slap that thing on it. You look just as terrifying. But the silicone keeps it from evaporating, and so it just mushes into your face for the 20 minutes you take it off, and then you remove that and you wash it. You can use it again, but you get all the benefits of that, like, extra cooking time. Yeah,
so you're also giving a facial to the planet.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I'm sure someone could find a disgusting analogy of what that is.
That's when I say it. When you say it, it's something very sweet and about skincare. When I say it, it's me being a little freak.
A little freak. So yes, reusable, I'm highly up on this. If anybody else is out wondering about them, give it a gozer.
Ooh, Good to know. Look, you know we have great friends who make great guests, and guess what? This episode is no different. This is another esteemed film critic, returning guest, and look, friend of the pod, Carlos Aguilar. What's good?
Woo! Yay!
Thank you for having me. It's always fun to be here. What's good? I went to a flea market this weekend in Long Beach, and I love flea markets. It's one of my favorite activities to do. The thrill of just, you know, walking around, seeing, you know, weird old used stuff and seeing what's cool, you know, but find a bunch of movie stuff, movie memorabilia, ephemera. You see people dragging, you know, carts of furniture they're buying, or people fighting over vintage clothing and stuff. So I feel like flea markets are underrated activities. I very much enjoy them. The sort of unknown of finding weird stuff. And on this one in particular, you could have a beer while you're shopping at 9 a.m., you know, so it feels like almost like being at an airport and like no rules apply in terms of like when you can drink. But yeah, so flea markets are what was good this week.
They know how to encourage an impulse purchase.
I like that you didn't say like, oh yeah, like it being at a resort or like being at a casino. You're like being at an airport.
You see people having drinks at, you know, ungodly hours at the airport because they're in a different time zone or they're on a bender or something.
No, you're not wrong.
Or they're about to get into a large metal tube that is, you know, being held aloft by magic.
People that could behave crazy or not. You know, you really don't know what you're going to get in an airport. So that's kind of what a flea market is. You don't know what you're going to get.
I like it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed.
Iffy, what's good with you? I tried to think of a connection, but you know I'm not gonna do a transition. Just what is good? It's all I want to know. Good.
This is another two-pronged one, and I'm kind of already knowing what I'm talking about, so it's gonna flow. They flow together. I'm gonna make it quick. First up, my friend of the pod, Matthew Lillard, has a whiskey company.
Lillard.
It's Questin Whiskey, which is like they're all themed after, you know, fantasy things, and my friend Kate Welsh does like a story, like a whole book comes with it, and there's like a ongoing story that's going between all the themed ones. And the first one was Paladin, this next one is Rogue, and it looks like the next one after that is going to be Warlock. So just wanted to shout him out, and you should get it if you're a fan of whiskey, D&D, or the movie Scream. And then the last thing I want to say that I do think connects with this fantasy stuff is that pieces of my Ren Faire costume is coming, because this Sunday I will be at the Ren Faire, but I'm getting all dressed up, baby. And I got my big floofy pants. They're right here. I'm gonna have my big black boots, and of course I'm gonna be just got my harness that normally they don't see the light of day. They're at kink events at night, but now they're gonna be out in public in the sun because I'm gonna be a medieval leather daddy. So a lot's going good. It's gonna be even better when I'm sipping on mead, just living life.
Sipping on mead. Laid back.
Never have I been more terrified to ask the question, do you have a jerkin?
I don't have. See, it's just funny that you asked, because that was a big like bounce between, because I was like, because I was leaning more. The reason I have the crossbody kind of harness is because I was leaning more towards like the barbarian style, and mm-hmm. I was deciding whether I was going to do. And you, it's funny you should say that, because I couldn't think of the name. I kept looking up kilt, I was thinking of doing like a jerkin-esque thing, but I was like, it's gonna be hot, because it's out here in Irwindale, which, if you don't know, it is a hot ass part of the SoCal area. So I was like, that's why I'm gonna be more naked. It wasn't just to be slutty, that's just a bonus, but a jerkin would rip. I'd be down for a Max film Renaissance trip where we all get jerkins. We can live your best Jane Austen fantasy, Drea. You can finally have it here. Oh man,
I need jodhpurs and pantaloons.
Ooh, yes, that I did know the name of, and unsurprisingly, for another kink reason, I was buying latex pants from Stockroom, and I was like, these look like those Mountie pants. What are they called? And that's when I learned. Oh, y'all steam the pictures, Gus. I sent it to you. Man, I'm telling y'all, it gets wild in the Max Film group chat. the pictures I subject everyone to
after dark.
Yeah. But we cooking. But you know who else is cooking? Linda's mom. We're cooking up some chicken for Linda. Then we're going to pitch ideas for movie based on childhood memories. But first, it's time for Itadic, our movie news segment, where we read through the week's movie news and decide if it's important and if we care. Drea, you going to start this off?
Oh, I sure am. Mm-hmm. All right. This is actually a bummer news, but Participant Media closed up shop this week. The studio behind a number of prominent indie films, both narrative and documentary, abruptly shut its proverbial doors last week after its billionaire founder, Jeff Skoll, decided it was time to get out of the film as philanthropy business. For the past couple decades, Participant focused a lot of its efforts on films that tackled social and environmental issues like An Inconvenient Truth, Spotlight, Green Book, and Roma. Is this important? Do you care?
It's infuriating, because usually when doors close at some entertainment industry entity, like it's a bankruptcy or they got bought up by somebody else. This is literally the guy who's like, well, I thought this was a good idea, but now I'm just don't care anymore, walking away. Yeah. And it's like, dude, this is a company that created a lot of really great films and also like did a lot of good in the world. And I think we're, if you're a documentary filmmaker, you're now seeing one of your major potential sources of backing just poof, gone. Not to mention that like they had an incredible staff there. Like every time you hear one of these stories about, oh, they're closing their doors, like there are dozens and dozens of people who are now looking for work. And a Participant, because they did good stuff and because they were, I guess, a good place to work, I know a lot of people who were there for a long time. And so they're terrific, and they're now like, brushing up their resumes. And so all of that sucks. I hate everything.
I literally had a meeting with participants the day before this got announced, and none of them knew. I mean, it was like just one of those completely blindsided things. I'll say in addition that there are people who know film really well and care, but more than that, like a lot of what they do are impact campaigns. So if you're looking at something like Spotlight, it's not just, oh, we helped roll out the film and make sure it's doing educational or informative or interactive, like doing events in different places that build community, that expand what the films are talking about. It's truly heartbreaking because, again, those are people who care. Like, if you work in a spot where it involves so much of your heart, and I think a lot of people who listen, whether or not that's in the film business or otherwise, anything kind of nonprofitville, there's so many things that what you're doing is so much more than a 9-to-5 in terms of its emotional toil. And then to have that crumble, like Alonzo said, on a feeling that feels more whim driven than anything, because it's not really, a lot of this stuff was never going to be qualitative in the way that, we registered impact on 43% more white women in Texas last year. Like, how are you you're doing good in the world through storytelling. It's a hard metric to prove.
So. They aren't selling Inconvenient Truth, you know, backpacks. Like, you know, it's not your traditional movie theater.
They did, but they were disposable. So well, they've all thus disintegrated.
Biodegradable. Yes. This is why you have to tax rich people, because their philanthropy is such a whim for them and such a, like, I'm going to focus on this because I think this is important and screw everybody else. And then, and now I'm just going to not do it anymore because I don't feel like it.
Yeah.
But it's also, you know, it was around for 20 years and all of a sudden just disappears, you know, from one day to the next. It's just like there was no plan for kind of a, you know,
no exit strategy.
For any of the production still, you know, going, or the people that are, you know, surprised that they don't have a job anymore after being there for decades. It's kind of insane that the entire company relied on, you know, a single person's desire to, you know, to use some of their money, which is probably not significant for them, you know, but clearly everyone else it was.
It's so weird. It's like billionaires shouldn't exist. It's crazy.
Exactly.
It's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. No, that is unfortunate. And I think it is, you know, tough just kind of like tossing it aside. Speaking of things being tossed aside, Tarantino is scrapping The Movie Critic as his 10th and final film. A little over a year ago, news broke that Quentin Tarantino had found his next project. It would be called The Movie Critic and star Brad Pitt in the title role. Tarantino has been vocal about his desire to have his next film, his 10th, be his last. He even shared that the film was set in California in 1977. A few drafts later, Tarantino has changed his mind about The Movie Critic. He told Deadline he had a change of heart. No update yet on what project he might pursue instead. Is this important? Do you care?
I mean, on the one hand, I feel like, you know, I was interested in seeing what he would do with the premise of a film critic. But at the same time, I don't know if Twitter could survive a movie about a film critic. I feel the takes that we would have gotten out of this movie would have been insufferable. So maybe we're just better off spare.
Well, of course, Brad Pitt would be playing the lead. I mean, you know, look at any room full of us and just immediately think,
right here in this Zoom that clocks. I want you to know I'm personally disappointed about this because I spent a lot of time trying to convince people that Brad Pitt was playing Gene Shalit. And that I'm sad to never get to do again. This one, like, I think I found out because Ingu texted me this, and that's how I find out most things in entertainment related is because Ingu Kang texted to me. That's my pulse. That's my finger on the pulse is just my phone connection to Ingu. But this one, it's ultimately what this feels like is Quentin Tarantino set up something. However many years, he was like, I'm going to make 10 films. I'm going to be so bad at it. It's going to be this whole thing. I'm going to make 10 films total. And that mofo currently has 9 films. And now he's just going to be plagued till the end of his days with what his final story it is. It's got to be so good. It's got to be the best one yet. It's got to be better than Kill Bill and Inglourious Bastards combined. Like, he has absolutely screwed himself with this completely arbitrary distinction. And I really think he should rectify it by making the movie critic with Brad Pitt and Gene Shalit. That's what I think.
It's not like we expect directors to be telling the truth when they say they're going to retire, because they never do.
Ask Soderbergh. That guy's retired 18 times yesterday.
Ask Hayao Miyazaki. Yeah, you know, so it's just like, Tarantino, say it's going to be your last film and then just pull a Cher and be like, oh, actually, no.
I'm going to do this again.
You know,
I'm going to do 12 or something. You know,
yeah, let it go. Who cares? Yeah. Just do your thing.
They used to say Doctor Who would only regenerate, you know, 13 times. It's never, nobody's sticking to that. Just pick a number, make it up, do another one.
There you go. All right. Well, hey, speaking of making up numbers, the Academy has announced new rules for next year. A handful of updates to rules for the 2025 ceremony. In order to be eligible for nomination, films will need to be screened in a brick-and-mortar movie theater for at least one consecutive week in one of a handful of U.S. metro areas. Drive-ins no longer count. Best picture eligibility will require a much more complicated theatrical run that involves, like, I think the top 10 markets or something. Other rules were changed as well. For example, any foreign animated film submitted for best international feature will now automatically become eligible for a best animated feature nom. Is this important? Do you care?
I think that last one is pretty good, because otherwise, you know, for the animation category, they would have had to have a theatrical run in the U.S., and a lot of those international animated films don't have distribution, and so they have to, like, kind of a four wall, like Lemley Theater, or, like, you know, just to qualify. So that feels kind of like a good thing. I think another part of the rules that you mentioned for the 10 markets for the best picture, I think distributors have to release the film. They could do a qualifying run, but they now only have 45 days to do, like, the actual bigger release, which I think is interesting, because sometimes distributors, you know, release a movie for a week in December and then wait 5-4 months to release it again. And I feel like that's always strange to me. So I feel like, you know, they're trying to probably kind of cut down on that.
Yeah. It will make it feel more like the films of that year, which is a nice component. Sure.
And shout out to Dallas-Fort Worth, which made the list of major markets, which has always been a huge film market. I mean, like, y'all, people need air conditioning there for a very large percentage of the year. So there's, as somebody who ran a film festival there, I can tell you, like, they're a very big market. Like, I remember in the early 90s, like, Weekly Variety would run, like, the LA theater totals, the New York theater totals, and then the DFW theater totals. Like, it was considered, like, indicative of how, like, the middle part of America was going to stuff. So I wasn't surprised to see it on the list. But yeah, for a lot of markets like Dallas and, you know, Chicago, Atlanta, the Bay Area are being looped into this. So it's not just going to be this, like, oh, we did our week in New York and LA and then anything beyond that, whatever. Like, now they've really gotta get out there into the trenches and into some other markets if they want a best picture consideration.
And I appreciate that. Like, as you guys know, I'm the nominations producer for the Spirit Awards, and we have the opposite ruling in that we no longer require theatrical releases. And part of that is us looking at independent film. So many independent films, if they don't qualify through one of our eligibility festivals, then they qualify through a release. And it is not, it's cost prohibitive to say to an indie film, like, you have to four wall or whatever.
Right.
The Academy, it's the same kind of economic divide in who's going to get those, but that's already in case. Like, if you're running an awards campaign, it's absurdly expensive. However, we as a group that loves things in theaters as an option and what that means for our art form and to keep it going and to keep, you know, it just gets more attention. So many things just go to digital and they're just lost. So I would hope that this expansion of where they can do these qualifying runs means that people in Dallas or whatever will get a shot to see a qualifying film in a theater that would have maybe completely evaded them if it just was released on streaming.
It does feel like a rule specifically, you know, put in place to sort of force Netflix and all the streamers to,
oh, for sure,
you know, to not only utilize their theaters that they have in LA and New York and have to actually engage with other theaters in other cities.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. They do all these awards for three companies. Or all these new rules are for three companies. Yeah.
I do want to stand up for drive-ins, though. Like, they should count. Right. Like, there's not that many left, but I mean, like, they're a theater. That should count.
That feels like, oh, we used you during the pandemic. We don't care about you no more.
Exactly. Yeah. Now we discard you.
Mm-hmm. I know. That sucks because I feel like. Yeah, I think you're right, Alonzo. It's a valid way to see a film, and you know,
for sure,
it's a fun time. Well, on that note, we're gonna go to a break. But when we come back, it's time for Chicken for Linda.
Hey, when you listen to podcasts, it really just comes down to whether or not you like the sound of everyone's voices. My voice is one of the sounds you'll hear on the podcast Dr. Game Show, and this is the voice of co-host and fearless leader Joe Firestone.
This is a podcast where we play games submitted by listeners, and we play them with callers over Zoom we've never spoken to in our lives. So that is basically the concept of the show. Pretty chill.
So take it or leave it, bucko. And here's what some of the listeners have to say.
It's funny, wholesome, and it never fails to make me smile.
I just started listening and I'm already binging it. I haven't laughed this hard in ages. I wish I'd discovered it sooner.
You can find Dr. Game Show on MaximumFun.org.
Hello everyone and welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Ify Wadiway. In the studio with me are...
Drea Clark.
Carlos Aguilar.
Alonzo Duralde.
Today's movie premiered at a little section of the Cannes Film Festival called ACID, Association for the Diffusion of Independent Cinema. The acronym works in French, too. It was written and directed by the husband and wife team of Chiara Malta and Sebastian Laudenbach, and released under Studio Ghibli's G-Kids label. So, Drea, would you mind giving us a brief synopsis of Chicken for Linda?
All right. So this is an exquisitely animated film, and we'll dig into that, in which we are plunged. If you, like me, heard this title and for some reason assumed this would be Spanish because you heard Linda, and it's not your mom's name, though it is mine, and you thought it meant, like, beautiful. It's French! And that's right, you're in the heart of Paris, and you begin with an opening of baby Linda and her parents, and then as they're cooking for her, or the father is cooking for her, he perishes, and then we bounce ahead when Linda is a few years older and now sort of a wily elementary school kid, and in grief for her dad that she's not able to talk to her now single mother about, and with a mishap involving a piece of jewelry that is symbolic and meaningful to them both, it sets off this whole excursion in the world where Paulette, Linda's mother, has to make chicken with peppers, which also sounds disgusting, for Linda. It's all she wants. And it also happens to be the meal that her father was made the last night of his life. It is absurdist and wild and amazing. And there's like a cacophony of villagers, even though, again, it's in Paris, or feels like it is. And it's all set during a general strike. There's absolute mayhem and adorableness. Best kids ever. Chicken for Linda. Yeah. Guys, I don't know. It may not be in Paris. I could have gotten that immediately. But they live in like this housing, which to me read as Paris.
Yeah, I think it is the suburbs of Paris. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks, man.
Well, you know, this film was such a fun kind of like shock, I'll say, because, you know, G-Kids is known for, like, anime. So, like, when I was going into this, I was just going, like, oh, we're watching, like, a Japanese animated film. And so I was like, oh, this is, like, an interesting, like, Japanese animated film that's in France. Okay. Because, you know, they love a Eurocentric setting.
Sure, sure.
And then eventually I had to be like, oh, this is French. This is French. But yeah, no, it was great. Because, you know, French people, they're not afraid of grief. They say, we're going to hit you with it in the first couple of seconds. And then we're jumping into it. And really just riding that train the whole way through.
Can I Can I actually piggyback on that,
Iffy? Yeah, of course.
That it's interesting because I'm familiar with G-Kids on a programming level. Like, My Life is a Zucchini, we played somewhere. Mm-hmm. We've played some of their things, like, at LA Film Festival. And like you said, they also have a lot of kind of Japanese work. But I, for some reason, I knew this was G-Kids, but I did not think of this at all, that it would be a children's movie. And I did not think that the entirety of it until it finished. And then I went and looked it up because I wanted to know about the filmmakers. And I was like, oh, man, they're calling this a children's movie. And that is actually the best part of the Frenchness of it. Like Alonzo said, the first scene, you know, you're seeing this papa and he's cooking and whatever. And then he sort of, I say, dies off camera. It's animated, but you're like very aware. Oh, this gentleman is leaving this mortal coil. And there's a matter of factness of how that death is. That is very childlike in the sense that there's an emotional processing that is the bulk of this movie for both Linda and her mother. But it's not trying to give you what I think a very American, like, a tendency of presenting death as like this big weepy moment or this thing to like, there's just a really unique matter of factness. And I actually think that makes it more interesting for kids to view. Cause at first I was like, isn't this too dark for a kid? But man, wouldn't that be nice to get in touch with your feelings right away?
Did you see Up?
I did, but I don't think a lot of kids are looking at like, The parts of Up that 7 minutes sequence that makes me weep, a lot of kids are not like, oh, I'm a life built with a partner and brr, brr, brr. Like, they're like, oh, grandpas die. Well, like, I mean, grandmas die.
First of all, that was Iffy's observation, not mine. But yeah. I think that, you know, the Disney dead parent trope has become like such a sort of given with most of their movies. I thought this one at least handled it, you know, both delicately and directly, which is not a thing that Disney often.
Thank you.
You might get one or the other, but maybe not both. Yeah. But yeah, I was delighted by this movie because it is so rare in my job to be surprised by something, just not in terms of not only just that it exists at all, which this is a real delight, but that I had no idea where this was going. Like, this is this very small, you know, they're not out to save the world. They're trying to make chicken with peppers, but all the grocery stores are closed and no one in this movie knows how to cook until late in the game when, thank God, somebody does. And so I was having a lot of anxiety about the not cooking going on here. And I'm not even a great cook, but I knew enough to know, like, somebody better take those peppers out of the oven. The whole building is going to burn down. I think this is delightful. And actually, Carlos is one of the people that really, like, was waving the flag for this early on and be like, you guys don't miss this movie.
I agree. I was so surprised. Like, I just didn't know where this movie was going. And I kept on laughing and losing my mind at the insanity of the things that, you know, that this mother, you know, kind of goes through just to get this chicken, you know, out of guilt. And that, to me, the notion of, like, you know, that's the adventure, to having to, you know, finding a chicken and, you know, then who's going to kill it? How are you going to kill it? Who's going to cook it? And all the, you know, sort of like mishaps that happen, to me, that's like, that's really the adventures that we all go through in life every day. Right? Like, we're not trying to save the world. We're trying to make it to the post office before it closes, to, you know, send a package or, you know, whatever is the kind of like everyday battle that we're going through. And I think there's a scene early on where, you know, they're driving back from Linda's aunt's home after the mom reconsiders the punishment, when Linda asks about the death of the father. And it's this very quiet conversation as the mother's like erratically driving, and the mom kind of accepts that she doesn't have the answers, that she doesn't really know. And I think that, to me, is the reality of it. Like, you know, the mom is kind of like mother, like daughter in a way, you know. Yeah. The aunt, you know, kind of calls it out and says that, you know, they're more similar than different, you know, when we really look at it. But just I love how the smaller characters are also very peculiarly, you know, created. Like, they all have personalities and their own little own worlds and battles. You know, there's a truck driver who's trying to visit his mom, who I think is Spanish. And then, you know, the sister or the aunt who has a yoga class and who loves candy and tries to, you know, cope with her life through candy, you know. We haven't even mentioned the musical numbers. This is a musical, which is incredible.
The first musical number comes in literally halfway through. It's exactly halfway through. It's great. And you're like, Aunt Astrid's singing. We're in a singing. What's happening? But it's great. It's her interior. It's what a musical should be.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's what's so funny, because one of Marissa's first questions here is this a children's movie? And I, you know, before that, I would almost argue it's like, well, it's so funny because it's like, what, you know, we've had this discussion when it comes to Ghibli movies, right? Where like, what constitutes as like an adult versus kids movie, and how, you know, we handle topics. I think in American animated films tend to be a little more kind of delicate, and I feel like both Studio Ghibli and I think just other kind of like animated films are like, oh no, we're just going to give it to you straight. Even though I think, like Alonzo said, like Bambi, you know, mom got clapped in the first 2 seconds, very, you know, and that, and we're off to the races. And I feel like as we've gotten, you know, more modern, we've kind of stepped away from talking about these hard things like griefs. And, but like, I think what really kind of put the cherry on the top of like, oh yeah, this is in fact a kid's movie, is when we get into the musical numbers, even though, you know, they, you know, it's done in a way that I think, you know, would make it feel like a musical. It is, I think this movie kind of floats that space where it's like, yeah, I see the children's movie, but I think everyone can sit down on the couch for this one.
Yeah, I think American movies just handle it in a weird way. Either it's very simplistic, or mm-hmm. whenever they try to engage with something, you know, they have to cover it with like a pop culture reference, or like a minion going banana, you know, while the mom's crying in the background, you know, which is to me like just the silliest thing, you know. So I feel like American animated films often just don't want to, just feel uncomfortable dealing with those things, and they simplify it, or they just, you know, put a silly joke to cover it up.
I haven't seen the show, but I know this is the discourse about Bluey that's happening right now. Mm-hmm. That is genuinely intended to be enjoyed by people of all ages. But of course, because mm-hmm. it is sort of aimed at kids or marketed at kids, there's a whole sort of like, oh, you know, they're your typical sort of snooty cultural vanguard to come out and complain about it. But apparently, like, David Milch likes Bluey. So relax, everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a whole article in the New Yorker that I found very funny that said that some parents were kind of annoyed that the parents in Bluey were very good parents and very thoughtful, and that now the standard for some parents is to be like Bluey's parents, that they have to live up to that.
Why can't you guys give my kids terrible examples of parenthood? That's what they should be watching.
And that's actually, in this movie, you get a yes. genuinely flawed mom. Like, she makes a huge mistake early on, and that becomes the driving thing of the rest of the movie, where she's trying to make up for it by making the dish happen. But of yes. course, she cannot cook. She does nothing but microwave. And, you know, and to like...
She can't even find a chicken at first.
Yes, no, I can't do any of this stuff. But also, there it connects it all together in terms of like finding the father's recipe book is a way of summoning his presence, which she has clearly been trying to avoid. Like, she doesn't talk to Linda about the dad. There's not a lot of evidence that he was, you know, in the apartment, like photos or whatever. And so, like, this act of cooking while Linda is directly demanding, I want to eat this dish because I remember eating it the night that he died, and it's the last thing he ever made me. It's also an indirect thing of, I want to summon the spirit of my father into our home again and have him be an active part of our mother-daughter relationship, even though he's not with us anymore. So there's just so much going on here, and it's hilarious, and we haven't even talked about how cool this movie looks.
It looks so cool. Each of the characters have a different color palette, so you really yeah. just have to like track those. And then, but the shape of them changes with like how close they are to the foreground, like all of these things.
They're very fluid,
I was absolutely, I'm telling you, I wanted the mother's wardrobe, and I say that her wardrobe is like the loosest of strokes. And yet I was like, oh, that is a skirt length I can get behind. You know how I know this movie's French? Because that woman's wearing a trench coat constantly. Like, there's no yoga pants going on here. And you're so, and the it moves along and it's vibrant. It gives you just enough sense of where you are with time and space to, like, give you in that. But it's not like, oh, can we render every hair follicle? Like, it is not interested in that. It's like, how evocative can these colors be in a moment? And the idea of, like, for a kid, you really sort of would, like, yeah, that's the sort of purplish woman in my life. Like, there's something about that that's very recognizable. I also love, there's so much great attention to detail, and it's such a frenetic building of pacing and energy. Like, it starts off so small. Like, it's this very domestic squabble between this little girl who's being impossible, her mother is at the end of her rope, and then you're on the little girl's side because you know that the mom is misreading a situation, and it's just, it spirals, and then it grows, and the world builds, and we meet more and more and more characters, and like Alonzo says, they're both fleshed out, but they also pertain to this story in interesting ways. Like, the school kids that you've met that Linda is friends with, you're like, oh, look at the empathy in these little kids, because they're like, while Linda and her mom are up to all these other shenanigans, they're like, all right, let's get to the heart of this chicken and pepper thing. What can we do? Let's go door to door on this chicken and pepper thing. Like, it's just a very lovely sense of community and world building. Even the bad guys end up being good and naked in trees, basically. There's romances that flourish out of nowhere. You didn't see them coming, but they're so delightful. My crush on that truck driver knows no bounds. Call me senor. Like, I just charm. Just charm from the tips to the toes.
Yeah. The director of one of the directors, Sebastian, he made a movie a few years ago that Jikits also released called The Girl Without Hands, and it's done in the same painterly style, but that one is a much, much darker, definitely not a kids friendly movie, about sort of like a mythical legend about this young woman who loses her hands in this kind of awful mythological way. And, you know, it's very moody and meditative about life. And but it's done in the same style, the color and the sort of like the hand painted lines. And so, yeah, I was very excited to see a new work that's completely tonally different. And that must be, you know, the fact that now he's working with his partner, and, you know, it's kind of like a collaboration more than just him telling a dark story.
She brought a little light to it. Was anyone else, the other truly French thing about this was, because they get a live chicken, right? Like, all the stores are closed for general strike. They explain what a general strike is twice. They're like, just dig into these politics. This is what this is all about. But then they're like, all right, we're going to go steal a chicken. And I was like, oh, how haphazard. Like, nobody's killing a chicken, right? Like, but the French people are like, oh, no, children need to know where chickens are from. This Pouillet is not going to make it to the end of the story in a way that you might like. Or you might. He looks delicious.
Although I'm class conscious, too, you know? Like, the fact that it's a general strike and that all these kids in this apartment complex are alone means that all their parents are working class and they're out there fighting picketing, you know? So it's really, like you said, everything connects in a beautiful way that kind of explains, you know, why are these kids alone? Well, because their parents are out there, you know, in the general strike, because they're all working class. And like you mentioned, the solidarity of the community element. I just think this movie is so incredible.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be a stealth faith-based movie, just because when they finally make it, they serve so many people chicken and peppers out of a not very large pot, and presumably still one chicken.
What chicken? So it's like, you can't give one person a whole leg. That's not how this chicken is divided.
That's a loaves and fishes situation.
Well, it reminded me of that other children's story that is something like the stone soup. You know, adds to it. So I was like,
well, people get watermelon too, you know. I think that they're like, they make up with some watermelon.
There is that, right. Yes.
The pastek, the watermelon comes on in. Yep. Good stuff.
Is this a movie that you would show to your kid?
Oh yeah. I feel like, you know, the beauty of like a film like this that is also like so visually dynamic is like, even if some of the stuff might go over the head or might, you know, it might not be something she attaches on, the way it looks is so exciting. I think that's the overall kind of like artistry of this film, you know, is, you know, we're doing the game later of like talking about childhood memories, but I feel like, yeah, this movie feels like a memory. It feels like you're not watching it in the moment, but you are kind of seeing a retelling of something someone remembers in their childhood. And that makes it even more beautiful in a sense, because it's a memory about a memory. Yeah. Because of that, you know, to answer your question, I think, yeah, it just would be awesome to kind of sit and look at.
It get the there's something about the color palette and the illustrative nature of the graphics that reminds me of like a 50s or 60s sort of French fashion magazine where like they'll have an illustrated, you know, layout or whatever. Like it's, you know, or like an old, like a poster from an old Jacques Tati movie or something.
It looks like the sketchbooks from Christian Dior, like the new look. Yeah,
for sure.
Okay, yes. Now vote.
The way we vote for things on this pod, you already know, Carlos, you are a loved guest, but just in case it's anyone's first time tuning in, Screen It being the highest, Stream It being the next level, Skip It being self-explanatory.
I would screen it in a heartbeat. In fact, I would like to do that because I watched this at home on a screener and I loved it. It was gorgeous. But this, I can only imagine between, like I said, just the beautiful color scheme, the musical numbers, all the other stuff, and just sharing this with an audience, because I think there is this sort of constant delight in where is this even going and how complicated is this very simple plot going to become? Answer, very. I would say if you can, keep an eye out for when it's coming near you and see it on the big screen. And if not, you'll still have a great time watching it streaming. But, you know, this is always preferable.
Yeah, we'll see it screen it too, for sure. It's just such a wild ride. I laughed out loud, you know, so many times in this one. I really didn't know where it was going. There's a moment where they finally make it to the apartment that I was thinking about, like, women on the verge of a neighbor's breakdown. Just yes. The wild things that are happening in that home is... just unpredictable. And just it is a beautiful film, in terms of the aesthetic and the kind of a commentary on parenting and children and sort of the notion that parents are just children that had to grow up, and that doesn't mean they have the answer. So just definitely screen it. I think this one's gonna endure in its in its power and its beauty.
Yeah, this one's a screen. It's such a delight. Super charming. It's only 70 minutes. So if you are adverse to like, oh, I wonder if my kid's going to be down with the subtitled work.
Yeah.
I think that it's manageable in its piece and it's so beautiful and it moves so quickly that even if your kid is not like reading every single line or something, I don't know. I think it'd be pretty easy to track like them running across town and getting in like... The mom gets arrested at one point. They're in the back of a truck. There's a car chase with the cop. Like, there's all sorts of things happening.
Shenanigans.
Shenanigans. But like I said, I found it a very fun and then meditative. I got real weepy at the end, which is not a surprise for anyone who's ever heard me talk about a movie. But like, unexpectedly, because you know where it's going. You know where this movie is going to end up. And yet it comes full circle in a way that felt so earned and so beautiful. And I was like, oh my God, they got there. They did it.
Beautiful.
Iffy, what about you?
Yeah. With me, it's a screen it. Easy layup. Heart makes you feel things. Animated really well. Yeah. I'm thinking that's a screen it. That's all I have to say about that. And we'll be right back after we hear from another show from Maximum Fun.
The Legend of Zelda, Tears of the Kingdom.
Diablo 4.
Final Fantasy 16.
Street Fighter 6.
Baldur's Gate 3.
Starfield.
Spider-Man 2.
Master Detective Archives Rain Code for Nintendo Switch? No, is that just me?
It's a huge time for video games.
You need somebody to tell you what's good, what's not so good, and what's amazing.
I'm Jason Schreier.
I'm Maddie Myers.
And I'm Kirk Hamilton. We're the hosts of Triple Click, a video game podcast for anyone who likes games.
Find us at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Maximum Film. It's your host, Iffy Wadiway. In the studio with me are...
Alonzo Duralde.
Carlos Aguilar.
Drea Clark.
We are going to pitch a childhood memory movie. I think I have one to kind of start. because, you know, thinking about this film and thinking about these kind of like connective tissues in your life, one of my earliest memories that I always kind of attribute to like eventually like wanting to be a comedian has been like, I remember it is like the earliest memory I have where like I accidentally had tasted hot sauce. And then like I was like as a kid like, oh, this is a lot, and I was kind of like rubbing my like cleaning my tongue off, and I remember everyone was kind of laughing and like thought it was so funny, and it was kind of like that like Joker moment where you're like the Joker complimentary moment where it's where you're like, oh, I've entertained these people, you know, maybe not in the through best my pain way. yeah but it was like, to me, I just remember that feeling as a kid of like seeing everyone so happy and like the pain kind of like very quickly subsiding, because I think it was Tabasco, so I don't even think it was like a super spicy thing. I remember just enjoying that. It was like everyone's laughing and having a good time and they're looking at me. So I imagine like a story like that kind of like starts off there and just kind of like pinpoints
you've been chasing that dragon ever since.
Yeah, exactly. Pinpointing like all these moments in this child's like life where they're trying to be funny, where they're trying to get that laugh that kind of like ends to that big moment where they're like going up to do stand up for the first time, but like kind of starting off in this kind of sketchbook messy style like in Chicken for Linda, but as it progresses forward getting like tighter and tighter till it's just kind of like very detailed in that final moment.
Nice.
Works for me.
Yeah.
I want to help cast Tiny Iffy. Sign me up for that. I don't think I have a fully realized thing for this, because it made me appreciate this movie all the more, that the kind of the inciting incident of this, the meal or the misplaced jewelry, you know, all of those things, that those led to this broader, deeper story. And I was like, oh, well, mine led to broader, deeper stories in that my life is full of them, but I couldn't think of any, like, oh, this one really led to a lot of things. Like, did I cut my brother's hair behind the shrubs when he was 4 and I was 6? I sure did. Did it not look good? Nope. Did I get in trouble? Probably. But, like, that didn't lead to anything. I'm now not, like, a world-renowned, like, hairstylist or something. Sadly. But true, I do cut my own hair, though. I do want a little credit. I can thank my brother, my first, you know, victim. Head that I practiced on. Victim, exactly. But mine, I was thinking in the idea of, you know, everyone's, like, has like very particular family stories, like those are the ones that like cycle up every time you're doing remember that time. And one of the most fundamental Andrea Diane Clark youth stories was when I was in, so I've heard this story more than I remember it, but I do think there's like a movie element in some of it. Basically in fifth grade or something, or nope, sorry, kindergarten. I was 5 in kindergarten, and I went to a really big elementary school in St. Paul, and apparently a new girl moved in, and I found out that her mother had passed away, and I wanted to befriend her, and to do that, I told her my father had passed away, really tying back to the what's good, huh?
Whoa.
And invited her over for a slumber party, and it really, she was like a very shy, I've always been friends with the timid underdog, and so really befriended her, took her under my wing, and then her dad called our house about this sleepover, and my mother answered, and then midway through it, he was consoling her and like invited her to like a parent, like a spousal grief support group, and she was like, "What? No, that idiot's in the other room. You need my husband? What are we talking about?" And he's like, "Oh, I think your daughter killed your husband." So like that's just been this long thing of how I killed my dad when I was 5. So do you see what I'm saying? Like it's sort of an inciting incident.
Sure, sure. Know.
But someone, it needs to be in someone else. I'm too close to it, you guys. Someone else needs to develop this material. But I do think there's something there of just me. Also, now everybody knows I'm a stone cold liar. You should never believe a single thing I say ever.
I was trying to think of something, but I think this will be more of a short film that, like you said, like, I don't know if there's anything that has, you know, that evolves into something as wild as Chicken for Linda. But when I was in elementary school in Mexico City, maybe I was probably from fourth grade or third grade, We had to make a piñata in a traditional way, which is like piñatas in Mexico traditionally are like in a clay pot. And so you use a clay pot and you like, you know, stick the cones and you sort of like decorate it and whatnot. But that's sort of like a traditional way. And we had to make one. And once you were done with your piñata, you had to take it up the stairs into like a patio where they were going to dry because, you know, they have like glue and whatnot and they had to dry. And I was just very proud of my piñata, and I was going up the stairs and I tripped and I went face first and I chipped half of my front tooth and the piñata rolled down the stairs and the piñata was intact. The clay pot did not break, but my tooth was destroyed.
Twist
and
ending.
I just could not believe that my tooth had broken and the piñata was fine.
Solid visual.
Yeah, it was one of those kind of miracles in the wrong way, you know, that the piñata survived. But
given the choice, yeah.
Yes, but you lost, you know, half of your tooth. So I always remember that being kind of like a trick to fate, you know, of like, your piñata survived, but your teeth won't. your tooth won't. So, yeah.
The priorities of fate, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, mine is also like it could be sprinkled into something, but it doesn't have like a three-act structure or anything. But picture, if you will, the summer of 1976. It's the bicentennial. In one station wagon are my parents and six children driving all the way from Atlanta to Boston for a college graduation, stopping in Philadelphia on the way to see the Liberty Bell because, again, it was the bicentennial. In Boston, we take on my brother who just graduated from college, all of his crap, and a cousin from Spain who would come over for the graduation and then just decided she was going to spend the rest of the summer with us. So that is now, for those of you keeping track at home, 10 people in one station wagon driving all the way from Boston back to Atlanta. Not surprisingly, somewhere in Maryland, we cracked an axle and had to pull over, but thankfully pulled over in the one place that had an auto shop, a motel, and a crab shack, which my dad was very excited about because he's a big fan of them. Anyway, it could be a sort of family-friendly National Lampoon's Vacation, perhaps. Yeah. But yeah, it will stay with me forever.
Who needs Wally World when you could be going back to Atlanta? Alonzo, I could make that whole thing. I love all of it. I like the Griswold energy.
I do have, and I have the gag for the closing credits. So because there was all these people and all the luggage, the mechanics who fixed the car, like put the, did the suspension way up. The next day after we get home, my dad is driving to the hospital where he works and got pulled over because he was literally like 5 feet off the ground. And I don't know if they thought he was a, you know, like
a monster truck.
Exactly. Yeah. It was just, so anyway. That's fantastic. That's my childhood memory.
Okay, good. I like it.
All right. Do we have any more pitches?
No, let's take the staff picks,
please. All right. Well, then it's not a time for staff picks. It can be any movie at all. Who wants to start?
I want to go to bat for a little movie that is opening this weekend in New York and L.A., but it's going to be launching on digital May 7th. So even if you are not in New York or L.A., it's going to get to you soon. It's a documentary called Uncropped about legendary photographer James Hamilton. If that name means nothing to you, trust me, the photos will. This guy was a photojournalist in a very exciting time to be one. He worked for a rock magazine called Crawdaddy. He was at the Village Voice. He did stuff for New York Magazine, for the New York Observer, shot stills for directors like Wes Anderson and Bill Paxton, but also was like one of the first people to get photographs out of the Tiananmen Square massacre. Like did a bunch of cool celebrity stuff, but also like amazing, you know, he went to China, he went to Ethiopia and covered the war there. Like incredible life. And this guy is still around and a great storyteller. And he just, you know, watching him talk about his work and seeing the work and the people that he's, you know, his collaborators from the different publications and stuff. Wes Anderson talks about this guy very effusively and is in fact an executive producer of this documentary. It's just a fascinating time capsule of this great moment in American journalism that will never exist again. You know, now we've all got a camera in our pocket and there are no magazines to speak of or newspapers. And so it's just this, he was totally the right guy in the right place at the right time. So yeah, Uncropped. I highly recommend it. Check it out.
Nice.
Ooh.
I have also a smaller film that's coming out this when this episode does on April 26th, my brother's birthday, the, you know, woo-hoo, best haircut in the world. It is called The Feeling That the Time for Doing Something Has Passed by Joanna Arnau. It premiered at Cannes last year, which is a rarity. They don't show a lot of American films at this indie level, especially they don't show enough women films either. But
at any level.
At any level. But I think Joanna is such an exciting and strange talent. She stars in this, wrote it, directed it, edited it. Scott Cohen, that many of you may know from the Gilmore Girls.
Max Medina.
Yeah, Max Medina plays her sort of longtime BDSM Dom, who's like only marginally interested in her or what they're doing. It's funny and weird. It's her dealing with her family life and work life and sex life. She's naked for a lot of it. You're hearing this and you're like, are you describing Lena Dunham? But I'm not. Please know Joanna Arnau is her own thing, and I think it's like weird and perverse. And those two words are going to mean a lot to a certain viewer. And that viewer should check out The Feeling That Time for Doing Something Has Passed. Especially check it out in the theaters because, you know, these do not get there much and it's only in theaters right now. So look it up online. Hopefully it's near you.
Yeah, nice. Speaking of one that opened very briefly in theaters a couple of weeks ago, I think it was April 12th. It might be now playing some other smaller markets or on VOD soon. It's a movie from Canada called I Like Movies. Which premiered at TIFF, I think a couple of years ago now, by a director named Chandler Levesque. And it's a movie set in the early 2000s following a 17-year-old named Lawrence who wants to work at a video store, which is kind of, you know, a chain video store. So, you know, vaguely referencing Blockbuster. And, you know, he's very awkward and not a popular kid. He has a best friend who... maybe just getting a girlfriend, and that sort of breaks his heart. He wants to be a filmmaker, and he wants to work at this video store, and eventually he gets a job there, and it's sort of just a portrait of an awkward kid that, you know, finds you know, kind of hope for the future in movies, and the relationship that he forges with, you know, his coworkers who don't care about movies as much as he does. And yeah, just, it feels like a premise that you've seen, you know, or heard of a million times, but I think it's done in a way that just feels fresh. And, you know, the young actor who plays Lawrence, is very good at being unlikable. And
he's,
I think
that's awkward.
Yeah. And I think that's a quality that, you know, you have to find the right person to be unlikable and still not someone that you don't want to watch for 90 minutes. So, it just ties in with this kind of revival that we have of video stores and physical media and what it means to actually walk into, you know, a place like Vidiots or, you know, WAMI or these video places that we have in LA now. So, yeah, I think it kind of went under the radar, but deserves to be checked out.
Well, my first time hearing of this, but I sign me up.
He is just an absolute true to heart dork, and I'm a big fan.
I like movies. Yeah, which I think it's a simple title, you know, but clearly he likes movies too much.
Yes. Yeah, and my joint, my staff pick is going to be one of those rare occasions where, you know, we do a TV show that you can watch because it's just that good. And mine, if you haven't checked it out yet, is going to be Baby Reindeer. It's it's on Netflix right now. Holy shit. Just knocking it out of the park. And definitely one of those TV shows I feel comfortable staff picking because of like some of the shots in this is just the composition, the framing. Like it really is like, you know, I do love it when TV gets in their little, you know, prestige bag and they're like, oh, we're gonna like shoot this like a movie. Our AD is gonna hate us, but it's gonna look good. so yeah, shout out. I'm really digging it. It is on the Netflix if you have it, but
I will eat a hat. Not my hat. I don't wear hats. I'll eat Carlos's hat if that thing isn't nominated for Spirit Awards next December.
Ooh. What? Okay.
You heard it there first.
We heard it here first. And I'll supply the hat if it doesn't.
Okay, thank you.
But thank you to Carlos Aguilar. Woo! Where can listeners Carlos. Find your work?
Yeah. Thank you for having me. It's always a lot of fun talking to you guys about movies and life and Captain Crunch and whatnot.
And
which I feel like I need to taste this new improved version of Cinnamon Captain Crunch.
We hope if anybody takes anything away from this episode, it's that. Yeah.
Carlos, yeah. Where can people find you online?
On Twitter, X, you know, the hellhole that we're still sort of most of us hanging in. At Carlos_film. I'm usually posting things there, where there's articles or rants about things.
Articles or rants. That's what he trades in.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. And yes, of course, as always, Dre and Alonzo, thank you for another wonderful show. It's always great doing it with y'all. And you, the listener, thank you for listening. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, send us an email at MaximumFilm@MaximumFun.org or find us on any of our social media channels, which are all linked in the show notes. Next week, we're going to be talking about We Grown Now. Our producer is the wonderful Marissa Flaxbart. And thanks this week to Gabe Mara for helping us out.
Yay!
Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of Maximum Fun. Bye-bye.